This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning, and welcome to Community Matters. My name is Laura Sumner Kuhn, and I'm your host this morning. And I'm bringing to you a great discussion about open records and equity in the law. We have two special guests with us this morning. We have Margaret Johnson Zinkowitz, who is a former Racine and Milwaukee public defender. And part of her time as a public defender, she traveled around the state doing training with other public defender's offices about racial and ethnic disparity issues. And as part of that was also to broaden their understanding of the use of open records. Another person that we have with us today is CJ Rouse. CJ is a Racine City Alderman, and he represents District 11, which is the south central side of Racine near Humboldt Park. And so I welcome you both this morning. Thanks for taking time to be with me this morning.
Thanks for having us on.
Great. So one of the things we want to start with is a discussion of the open records law. And for our listeners who may not be aware, Wisconsin has had a pretty long history of having a progressive open records law. In fact, I'm going to read a little bit of the declaration of the state statute to us today. It says, in recognition of the fact that a representative government is dependent upon an informed electorate, it is declared to be the public policy of this state that all persons are entitled to the greatest possible information regarding the affairs of government and the official acts of those officers and employees who represent them. Further, providing persons with such information is declared to be an essential function of a representative government and an integral part of the routine duties of officers and employees whose responsibility it is to provide such information. To that end, State Statute 19.32 to 19.37 shall be construed in every instance with a presumption of complete public access, consistent with the conduct of government business. The denial of public access generally is contrary to the public interest, and only in an exceptional case may access be denied. And what's interesting about this provision in our state law is the fact that there have come into being several times in the Racine area in the last year, cases in which there have been city employees, in most cases, law enforcement personnel who have acted in a way that has either caused injury or death of people. And the people in those cases who have died or were injured happen to be people of color. Some of those cases include Malcolm James, who a year ago in Memorial Day weekend of 2021 had called 911 for help. He was in a mental health crisis. He ended up instead being incarcerated in the Racine County Jail because of his behavior that emanated from his mental health crisis at the time. And eventually he died in the custody of Racine County jailers. The public, including his family, implored Racine County District Attorney Patricia Hansen to release the body camera or the surveillance camera footage in the jail of Malcolm James so that there could be some transparency and full disclosure of how people who were securing him in the county jail acted during that time, and what was his death a result of? Was it a result of their actions? Was there something inappropriate that happened? The case was under investigation by Kenosha County, it happened again in May, early June, he died. And the release of that footage, unvarnished, never really happened until she made a declaration, never really happened completely. And she didn't rule on the case to see whether or not there were any criminal actions that should have been taken until January. So more than a half year later, when there was a decision. In the meantime, the Sheriff's Department released a portion of that video with some editorial comment, while the rest of the public was denied access, which seemed to be in violation of the open records idea of that only in exceptional cases should it be denied public access. We had another case again this May when a young Black man, DeShante King, was shot by a Racine police officer. That case is still under investigation with the Department of Justice as a way of seeing what is open to the public. I personally made a request for an open records for that video, the body camera video footage of the police officer in that shooting event. I directed it to the Racine City Police Department and to the Wisconsin Department of Justice and to the Racine County District Attorney's Office. And both the city police department and the Department of Justice responded denying my request, saying it's still under investigation. And I never heard a response from the District Attorney's Office. So these issues have become concerning in the Racine community, as in other communities where we see the disparity in treatment by law officers of people of color and of distribution of the law in regards to people of color. The public is looking for some transparency. So I thought that would bring us to an interesting conversation today. I'm wondering, Margaret, if you would talk to us a little bit about our better understanding of the open records law and how to make a request for it. Where are the gray areas that would allow there to be a denial of open records requests?
And I'll start first with just kind of why it might be useful to make an open records request. There are certainly uses with respect to specialized cases, for example, attorneys making a request for litigation, or the media making a request for some specific information for some publication that they may be doing, or for researchers to use certain data, again, that might be serving the purpose of putting together a study around a particular topic. But really, as you noted in the public policy statement surrounding the open records request, the idea is that the citizenry should be able to get this information, and it is to ensure the transparency. So, with requesting a public record, there are certainly different areas that have different nuances. But what I would suggest for someone who is trying to make a request would first be to make a request in writing and to make sure that the request is as specific as you can make it, providing as much information about the specific situation that you want, including maybe a time frame reference, like I want all the instances of whatever example that happened in the past 6 months, or I want information about a particular one instance that occurred on this and that other date. And to include in that request that you are doing this as a request for a public record. I would also include some information in the request specifically about how to contact you as the requester and what your parameters might be for any type of cost that might be incurred from doing this. The agencies are allowed to recover any costs that they may incur in answering your request. So that is something to take into consideration. And again, should be something to limit the specificity of a request. From there, kind of as you experienced, it's not unusual to receive a denial of your request. And what can be done with these types of denials is really an opportunity to figure out what you've not included. They should be including a reason as to why your information is not being provided. And that might be, for example, the information is too broad, or in your case, as noted, that the investigation was ongoing. But it is an opportunity to learn from what's going on in the denial and try again as a result of whatever suggestion they've made in denying your request. So I certainly tell people, if at first you don't succeed, try again with respect to these requests. And ultimately, if you are denied and you think you are being denied incorrectly, you do have the opportunity to bring a case to the circuit courts for review. And with respect to that, ultimately, then there would be a new set of eyes, the circuit court judge looking at the case and being able to make a determination as to whether or not the request should be honored. With respect to the records requests, generally speaking, there is a public records balancing test, which weighs the public interest in disclosure against the public interest favoring non-disclosure. And this balancing test should be done specifically looking at the facts of each and every request. So these are supposed to be done uniquely for a given situation and a given request. And there are times when they can be denied, and there are some other things that should be taken into consideration. With respect to some of the matters that you've mentioned, they can either be ongoing criminal investigations or closed criminal investigations. And with respect to ongoing, the balancing test should also include such things as whether or not the request would adversely impact the investigation of the prosecution, influence the testimony of witnesses, influence a jury pool, impact the defendant's ability to have an fair trial, and undermine the ability to determine if a witness is telling the truth. So these are some of the considerations that have been put out with respect to ongoing criminal investigations. And there are additional concerns with respect to closed criminal investigations, including Marcy's Law, which specifically speaks to the victims' rights statutes and a constitutional article for Wisconsin, and for making sure that we are protecting victims. There are some additional concerns with respect to the prediction of witnesses as well. Children and juveniles are also considered with respect to the protection of them. Officer safety and the consideration of law enforcement techniques is also to be considered.
One of the things that has come up in this discussion of the records that are produced by high technology, you know, we're in this world now where we do more than paper reports, right? We've grown in leaps and bounds. And so there are body cameras, there's surveillance cameras, there's dash cams, all of these producing data with the understanding that they will lead to some added understanding of some event. In these cases that we talked about where law enforcement personnel are involved, And may be under suspicion of whether or not there has been a crime committed, as in the case, let's say, of Malcolm James in the county jail. It seems somewhat unfair in the public thinking that the very people who are under consideration of perhaps wrongdoing have full access to that surveillance camera record, while the public who should have their trust and who are providing oversight of their position of power and the way they use power in law enforcement have been denied it under the guise of an ongoing investigation. There seems to be this gray area of when something has been time enough for somebody to conduct an investigation and when it's actually a record and should provide transparency and give equal access to people who want to make sure that the people we have given power to make arrests, carry firearms, uphold the law are in keeping with our standards of public safety and fairness. So what advice do you, what from your background, Margaret, can you say about that idea of, you know, kind of like this double standard of who has access to open records in those cases?
Well, it certainly can be a challenge. And I think at this point, we're seeing a shift with respect to the timing issue, as you mentioned. There are certainly cases that are occurring now that information is being released much sooner. And I think that now that we have these comparison cases that are coming forward, we are able to look at them and see, did the release of information much sooner harm the case in some way? And I think at this point, we need to be asking some better questions about that and having that discussion and seeing if there is a reason to delay the release as much as is being done typically under our current experiences here in Wisconsin.
That kind of brings us to you, CJ. CJ, you are in the process of introducing a new city ordinance in Racine that would require the release of certain data from high-tech data like body cameras, dash cameras, surveillance cameras. Can you tell us a little bit about your discussions? I understand that you've talked with people in Akron, Ohio, who have been among the first to pass such an ordinance. And can you just tell us a little bit of your research and what you hope to bring to the city of Racine?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. This is going to be modeled after the ordinance passed in Akron, Ohio, which by now is making national news for the police shooting of Jaylen Walker. But it also highlights the importance of this ordinance. Within 6 days, 13 angles of camera footage were released to the public unredacted, which gave them the opportunity to make that judgment for themselves and have that access to footage and give that air of transparency that we really all deserve from our public servants, whether it be in the police force or from local government. Our policy and our ordinance, the one that I'm working on, is very similar. Some of the differences is that Akron, Ohio releases within 7 days, but they are a larger force than ours and have their own departments set up for that. So ours, I'm looking at passing, would be 10 business days, which would require the release of footage involving incidences of police use of force resulting in death or bodily harm. It's also going to have an avenue to hold that us as the city of Racine accountable, where if somebody feels that we did not release information, pertinent information, that they can request that information be released. And should that information not be released, we'd be subject to penalties under our open records laws. Through the work with Akron, Ohio, which meeting actually took place the same day as the shooting of Jaylen Walker, they let me know that despite how things might look, they felt it was their duty to release this information and be as transparent as possible. And in my due diligence, I wanted to make sure that the ordinance similar to the one in Akron, Ohio, would not be discouraged by any state statutes or any other precedent that might exist in this city or state already. So I did contact a state representative from Racine and worked with their legislative service agency, which I believe is the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau, and did confirm that there are no state statutes that would interfere with such a policy. And timeline-wise, I'm hoping to get this through and available for vote at the Common Council sometime in August, and would encourage anybody from the city or even surrounding areas to come participate in these meetings as it comes out. It can really help show us what you want to see and what you want to hear.
Thanks. CJ, a couple things about what you're saying. Could you tell us a little bit more about the Jalen Walker case, if you can, if you're prepared? Our listeners may not be aware of what happened in that case.
Yeah, absolutely. So Akron, Ohio, there was a police shooting of an unarmed Black man, Jalen Walker, where he was shot 60 times. There were over 91 rounds fired in total. 60 of them struck this 25-year-old man. The footage of that was released 6 days after the incident. There was 13 camera angles that were released, and within 30 days, any other footage caught from any other angles will also be released. This footage is released directly to their website as well as YouTube. It's still obviously ongoing. They just did a press conference recently on it. But it's causing national controversy, but it also does point to the need of something like this. Because of that ordinance in place, no matter how the optics of that situation looked, the city of Akron and the police department were required to release the footage, and they did.
There are some interesting distinctions that should be drawn between the situation in Akron and what we might do here. So just in what you're saying, just to repeat, when they release footage like this, they release that data both to their own city website, and then they also release it to a YouTube channel that they have. Is that correct?
Yes. And the city website just carries a link to the YouTube channel in general, but they wanted something that was open and accessible to anybody, not only within the city, but nationwide and worldwide at that.
Okay. And is it their ordinance reads that within 7 days of an event, they have to release it. Is that correct?
Yes. Within 7 days, they were required to release at least 3 camera footage angles. And that can include body camera or dash cam. And then any other remaining footage has to be released within 30 days.
And when you had conversations with them, CJ, and I understand that you spoke with representatives from the police department too, What were their reasonings for supporting this measure?
Yeah, actually, they were very responsive to my request for talk. I had reached out to the mayor, who got me in touch with the police chief, who got me in touch with Captain Dave Lawhin, who was the one who releases the footage along with another team, which they're actually very supportive of it. They thought that their ability to maintain integrity of investigations, their ability to keep down any sort of disturbances was not more important than their duty to transparency. They figured first and foremost, they had a duty to transparency. And if there was any issues that came about that because of their conduct, then that was an issue with the conduct and training and not necessarily with releasing body cam footage. So even during this incident, because this happened in the morning right before our meeting, he let me know that they're still working to release it as fast as possible, and that despite what any optics might be, they felt it was their duty to release that image. And it helps them to tailor their training to keep their officers and departments under check, so that when incidents like this one happens, we have direct access within less than a week, and they as a city and their constituents can press for changes, and the rest of us in this country can relook our own practices and see what might work for us.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. For people who may not be aware, and you can straighten me out if I'm not recalling any of this correctly, but the city of the Racine also included a request for in this year's city budget, which was approved, purchase a $2 million purchase for high-tech policing equipment that included better body cameras. And some of their reasoning from the police department in making such a hefty purchase was to be able to comply with requests, open records requests for body camera footage in a more timely function, because right now the city does not have a separate department, as Akron does, to review body camera footage. And my understanding is that Police Chief Maurice Robinson has indicated that the way we review body cam footage in the city now, and probably, I don't even know if we have dash cams, but it's done kind of randomly and periodically by him, unless, of course, there is an incident such as the DeShante King shooting in May. Is there a need to be in place along with this ordinance that requires the city to do a better review of the data it's collecting on these kinds of high-tech equipment?
Yeah, and to speak to the budget item, I did pull it up. We passed $450,000 to begin replacement of body cameras and dash cams, as well as a multi-year commitment for our 10-year plan to increase funding throughout each of those years going forward for at least the next 10 years. And I remember part of that discussion was also not only the hardware, but the software that it takes to analyze that footage, to store that footage long-term. And with some discussions with our own police department, they said, well, one of the only things that might slow that process up was how long it takes to comb through that information, redact things that might be requirements for the state, whether it be minor information or other sensitive information. But at the same time, the use of this policy, where it would actually go through, is our legal department through our city attorney. So for the size of our city and the size of our force and the number of incidences we have, it likely could be one specific person within the city attorney's office that could handle all of these requests so that we can get it out in a timely manner.
This whole issue brings us to another one that seems to be of increasing importance in the area, certainly in Racine, which is the knowledge that you know we're sharing here today. And that is that there's a movement for intelligence-led policing. This kind of idea has now been under use in Racine, and I really don't know how long, but it was introduced when the Racine County executive, the Racine County district attorney, the Racine mayor all announced this violent crimes initiative in May. And the police, deputy police chief mentioned that we are moving here in Racine and have indeed moved to this intelligence-led policing. It's an interesting notion. Doing a little digging and research on it, it's a vague term, but in general, it suggests more and better use of high technology equipment in solving crimes in law enforcement. And while that, I think there would be few people who argue that when a crime has been committed, we would want to employ every tool available to us to solve it. There is some concern about this movement to more use of surveillance cameras, more use of technology like license recognition, facial recognition, spot shotter software that can sense when there is shooting going on in a particular neighborhood. Margaret, can you maybe talk a little bit about what you might have, what questions come to mind when you think about the use of this new intelligence-led policing, and where there might be areas of equal protection under the law, perhaps, that might come into question with this kind of strategy?
Certainly. And similar to your experience with intelligence-led policing, I too did the research and found very vague definitions with respect to it. So, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all version of intelligence-led policing, but it does tend to center around this technology, as you indicated. And there are concerns about this technology. Certainly, that one of the concerns is flatly, you know, does it work and how well does it work? And if we're using technology that is being sold to law enforcement by a third party, is this information about how this technology works covered by kind of the fact that it's a proprietary source? And is there a way to figure out how accurate this technology is, how it's being tested, and whether or not there are error rates or false alarms that are occurring? And there are suggestions that, in fact, that is something that is happening with this technology. And the challenges of getting the information about when that's occurring are significant, especially to use them in a defense in a court situation. In addition, there are the privacy concerns, as you indicated, certainly kind of tracking people's location and their movement can become a concern. And in fact, there have been some cases that have made it to the U.S. Supreme Court with respect to doing that. And their position is that individuals have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the whole of their physical movements because of the privacy of life that these movements can reveal. And one of the big cases that has specifically dealt with that and provided that quotation is this United States versus Jones, where there was a tracker being a GPS tracker following a particular car's movement for 28 days consecutively. And the court held that this was in fact a Fourth Amendment search and that the protections that applied there kicked in. So again, this is the kind of degree that the privacy issues are presenting. You know, are we concerned about, for example, that these cameras are so high tech that despite the fact that they're being posted on a street corner, they can in fact see in the house as well and see what's happening, for example, in your living room through a window. In addition, there are significant concerns with respect to placement of these types of tools and where specifically they are being deployed and what communities are being targeted by this technology. And unfortunately, there have been instances where this technology has been specifically deployed into minority communities, placing significant additional restrictions on citizens of color and the concerns that go along with that. In addition, there have been some concerns about whether, in fact, these increased surveillance type policing matters have actually helped out with respect to reducing violence. So there are several concerns with respect to the use of this technology. And I think that there is enough information about these concerns that any use of this technology needs to be done very carefully and with a plan in place to figure out how it's going to be monitored. I will note that Chicago is one city that has used this technology and various types of technology for quite some time. And there have been a lot of challenges that have come out of Chicago's experience with respect to the technology. There's been a lot of recommendations that have been made with respect to this technology as well. But I think it is very clear that any use of this technology should be carefully watched. And that would include keeping good track of data and watching what kind of trends emerge before and after the use of this kind of technology.
Yeah, I think it's a very perplexing idea that we're using high-tech technology, as you had mentioned, that can zero in on a certain neighborhood and follow the movement there before any crime has been committed, which seems to me an infringement of your personal rights. Like, it would be racially profiling people to only put that technology in communities of color, waiting for a crime to happen with the explanation that, well, then we can find out more about who committed the crime with this technology. It's a little big brotherish. And then in order for it to be employed as a policing strategy, obviously, if you're trying to do some crime detection, you have to have a certain kind of secretiveness to how you're watching people, but then how do you monitor that to make sure that it's used ethically and fairly in a community? It's one thing, again, when you're talking about employing this technology for to solve crime versus crime prevention, which seems to me to deny some basic civil rights to people who might be in neighborhoods of high surveillance. I know, CJ, that you were at the press conference where this whole violent crime initiative was announced. Why don't you talk a little bit about your reaction to what you heard that day as well?
Yeah, I'm always suspicious when it comes to trying to solve issues in the community on the reactionary side, because to me, any presence of crime, any presence of issues or violence stems from a root source that happens well before police contact. So overloading our efforts into attempting to squash crime from a police standpoint, it seems slightly disingenuous. So throughout that meeting, I was curious to see, well, what are the efforts that would actually be crime prevention? And I would want specifics on that, because the vagueness of it leaves me worried, especially with issues that we've already faced. And I'll continue to press that on our end. I still haven't gotten too much of clarity on what those things will be. As both of you have said, there's a lot of vagueness in it. And at this point, it's going to be a lot of waiting to see so that we can keep an eye on to make sure there aren't violations of people's rights, that this isn't further pressing us to inequitable places. But I am curious to see what they come up with, and I will try to work with our police departments to make them the most effective that I can, if that is where we are investing our time and our money. But for me personally, I see uplifting community as a way to reduce crime. I see as giving access to resources to people in need. And that doesn't have to come from the police department.
I think you bring up a good point that, you know, sometimes the statement of how good a community is where it invests its resources. And if we're investing so heavily in policing, what does that say about us as a community? Not that we don't have violent crime or that police aren't necessary. Of course they are. And of course there is violent crime. And I think we all want protection. I think that's what makes this issue so difficult, because there's a fear reaction that happens to most people when you talk about violent crime and the possibility of it happening in your neighborhood or in your community or in your family. And so there might be an immediate sense that this makes sense. It keeps me safe. But the reality is we should be asking really hard questions about what does this kind of mindset about keeping a community safe or building a healthy community actually do to us? And are we, this is a question I have, and maybe Margaret, you could jump in here with some of your insight, but are we building another a pathway to incarceration for Black and brown people who are living in communities that are depressed, and they might be in high crime areas because they're depressed areas economically. And are we leading again to that pathway to prison, much like the drug wars did in the 1990s? What kind of flags come up for you? And have you seen anything in those Chicago cases that you've looked at where people are saying, hey, you know, we're going to challenge this because... can you give us some examples maybe, or your reaction?
I would say that this is certainly a risk, and that the Chicago cases have echoed this concern, and they have really continued to push for data collection that is putting a watch with respect to this issue, and whether or not specifically citizens of color are being greater impacted with respect to this use of technology. There's been some studies done with respect to that, and they've been more limited to certain areas, and they have shown some concerns. There have been some challenges with respect to that as well. But even to your comment about, you know, maybe this is something that we would be willing to consider if, in fact, there is a crime reduction piece of this, I think it's important to keep in mind that there are also studies suggesting that that's not even what's happening with respect to the use of this additional technology. So there may be instances where the technology is just incorrect. It's not effective. And in fact, when it's, you know, triggering in different cases, it may be triggering in a way that is having a disproportionate impact on communities of color. So I think it's concerning for all of those reasons.
Well, we just brushed the surface of some of these really deep concerning issues in our communities. And Racine certainly is not the only community grappling with this. Milwaukee, Kenosha, anywhere is, you know, kind of deciding what is a safe and equitable way to move forward with our communities, and how do we keep people safe, but yet stem crime? Every day we hear of new shootings like the one recently on the 4th of July in Highland Park. So, you know, there definitely are issues out there that we expect to be resolved through good policing. But where's that fine line? So I appreciate both of you joining me today to just have this conversation and bring it out into the public a little bit more broadly. And I look forward to seeing what happens this summer, CJ, with your proposed ordinance and what will ultimately happen. For people who want to contact you, what's the best way that they can do that?
So all of my contact information is available on the City of Racine's website. I'm also on Facebook at Alderman CJ Rouse. They can call, text, email, message, or comment. I'm available from 5 a.m. until 2 a.m., 7 days a week.
All right. And Margaret, I trust that you will keep a watchful eye on what's happening in this community as well as others, since I know that is your passion.
Definitely. Thank you for having me on to discuss the concerns.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us today. And I have a feeling that maybe we'll come back and revisit this idea a little further down the road. So thank you for making this a wonderful show today.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.